Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today we're talking about conflict management at work. This is a topic that's not simply important for managers, but for employees at all levels of your organization. Consider how many hours your HR team spends dealing with personality conflicts. If your employees had the skill set to manage conflict independently, how much additional time would your HR team have to handle the implementation of larger goals and objectives? Today, our guest is Carol Bowser, attorney and founder of Conflict Management Strategies. And today, we're going to be discussing best practices for empowering employees to effectively manage conflict at work. Welcome, Carol. Thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure to be here to talk about my favorite subject, conflict.
Well, it's interesting because I think as much as all of us wish that this wasn't something we had experience with, we all do. Whether or not it's something that in my situation, you know, is going to rise to a legal claim or a cause of action or something like that. In most situations, it's not. It's going to be something where two individuals or two groups of individuals just see things from a different perspective. And it's not just other people's problems. These are problems that each of us experience on a day-to-day basis. So I think it's just such an important topic. And I'm really excited for us to be talking about it today.
Yeah, me too.
So before we really jump into the meat of things, when I have a guest, I always think it's very important for our listeners to understand why have I invited you to talk about this topic? So can you give our listeners a little bit more information about yourself and why you decided to get into kind of focusing in on the conflict management arena?
I think it's fascinating that we have conflict all of the time. And I went to law school because I had some iffy employment experiences. You know, generally what leads us down a particular path is either an opportunity or an experience that we want to do something different. And so I was an employee and I had a couple of experiences that on reflection, I'm like, well, had I known what my rights and responsibilities were in that employment relationship, would I have made the same choices? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. But then in retrospect, looking at what I didn't know at the time were the employer's rights and corresponding responsibilities. Because as you know, if there's a right, there's always a corresponding responsibility. My initial was, hell no, I would have done something different. And learning about rights and responsibilities, my brain says, well, where do you go? You go to law school. Right about at the same time, I kind of recognized that I was in the position I was in as an employee and as a person because of things that I did and things that I didn't do, things that I said, things that I didn't say, knowledge that I kind of blissfully assumed that the employer would share with me. And that I think it was a bit of a naive employer, a big employer, but kind of a naive employer in how they trained and suited up their management team. So right around that time, I started learning more about mediation, where people come together to do their dispute resolution. And so I thought the idea of resolving disputes was really great. I thought it was really empowering. And I said, like, oh, well, I want to be, you know, a judge. That sounds really great. And then the more I learned about being a judge, I'm like, I do not want to do that. you know, I wanted to do it as an avenue to become a mediator. Because as someone once told me, you got to get some life experience and you got to get some professional experience before you're going to have any credibility where people are actually going to listen to you. So I took mediation training at a local community-based mediation center. And, you know, as an attorney, when attorneys use mediation, they generally mean it within the process of like filing a lawsuit or filing a claim or things like that. The mediation center that I went to was more kind of community-based. So they were interested in landlord-tenant, dissolution of marriages, parenting plans, neighbor to neighbor, vendor to customer. So the underlying girder of that was that there was going to be some type of ongoing relationship. So I got grounded in that, and I went to law school and I practiced employment law. And after a while, it's like what I really loved about the mediation, about talking to people, finding out what was important to them, finding out how we could teach or train or empower people. That was so little of the actual practice. It was like playing 28 different chess games at the same time, trying to figure out how someone is going to try to mess with you. And also, we call it the justice system. It's a dispute resolution system. And people came with a lot of different ideas about what their personal a definition of justice was, and were constantly disappointed in the system. So something that was causing time, money, effort, life energy, a total suck of where your life is invested, wasn't giving any type of resolution. And in fact, you were giving over control to the attorneys who were experts in that particular system, and judges and juries who, again, were experts in a particular system whose definition of justice was notice an opportunity to be heard, not like, how is this impacting your life? You know, what is it you need from these people? So I transitioned and said, what can I do? Well, I can teach, I can train. I know I was training mediators at that time. I was still mediating at a fair amount, including with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So I just got an opportunity to slowly build and develop what became conflict management strategies.
Wonderful. You know, I first love hearing people's stories because I find that very rarely is it, you know, point A to point B that they like woke up one morning and they're like, yes, conflict resolution. That's what I want to do. But your story has so much self-reflection, which I think is so impressive generally. But then the idea that justice is personal, I think it goes so much to conflict and, you know, perception. When you're talking to two people and they've experienced the same event, they don't have the same perception of what happened. You're going to get two completely different stories. And I remember my first couple of months of practice as being an attorney, I said to a senior attorney, gosh, I just can't stand them because they're lying. And one of the best pieces of advice that I ever got was, it's highly unlikely that the person is lying. It's just that their perception has already been clouded or changed by their past life experiences, their current life experiences, and really our goal and our in being an attorney and in helping to advise is to figure out where in the middle is truth. And truth still, I think, is a very hazy kind of concept in and of itself. And that goes to that personal definition of justice, which I so very much agree with. And I think is a really important way to kind of structure conflict generally.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm for the HR and business owners out there, you know, when someone says, you know, they're patently lying, you know, they're lying about this or lying about this. So, you know, people are messy and people will, you know, sidestep, maybe obfuscate, maybe omit. I was thinking about this the other day, like they may be truthful, but they may not be completely honest.
No, I think that that's a wonderful way to look at it. You know, based off of all this, you have a ton of experience advising people, companies in conflict situations. So in your experience, why is it important that businesses make conflict resolution or skills in managing conflict a priority?
I have a couple of different reasons. One is a statistic that's out there. And honestly, I don't remember anyone specifically citing it, but something along the lines of vast amounts of managers' times are spent, you know, addressing interpersonal issues, kind of what you alluded to in the beginning, you know, and I always say, like, if we had conflict resolution skills, listening skills, negotiation skills, and we address things and train people early on in those, I think there would be a lot more time and bandwidth to do succession planning, to do strategic planning, to do skill development, and all of those things that businesses and organizations are crying out for now. That when we are so overwhelmed and we don't have enough time in the day, we're emotionally worn out or just irritated. We're not focused on the work. So I think that's one piece. The other piece is it's a retention issue. One of the things that I find is that people can talk about what they don't want, but they don't necessarily talk about in a way that can be heard by others versus being mentally shut down by others, meaning you're coming to me with a complaint. I don't want to hear a complaint anymore. I'm a parent. And if I get asked once, I say no, I get asked again. And then if I'm perceiving as though it's complaining and whining, I'm like, this just feels like a complaint. It feels like a whine. And if you're complaining and whining to other people, that looks like gossip and triangulation. And that makes me lose confidence in you as an employee. And so I think that that's really difficult. So if we can teach and train and role model conflict resolution skills, listening skills, things at all different levels, I think that the conflicts can be less frequent, possibly shorter in duration, and lower in amplitude. So as I said before, people are messy. Life is messy. And conflict and disappointment and frustration are going to happen because that's life. And life comes into work. And let's just kind of take a moment to train and teach and reflect for ourselves these life skills and try to pass them on.
No, I think that that's so important. And the thing is we know that people, or our goal is that someone doesn't come into work and, okay, they're their work self and then they leave. I mean, we're at a place in time where we want the whole person to be coming to work, the authentic person, and understanding that that authentic person is going to have other things that are going on in their life that's going to affect how they move, change, and interact with others, I think is important. But fundamentally, all the things that you've just discussed are happening, are going to happen, and figuring out how to manage it is important. It's likely that a lot of our listeners are probably thinking to themselves, okay, Tani, like, you're giving us this information. Carol sounds amazing, but I only manage blue collar employees, or I only manage white collar employees, and the conflicts are different. I mean, in your mind, is the way that we manage conflict based off of the type of work that we do different, or are there kind of similarities?
I would say yes. And the lawyer and mediator answer, it depends. So I want to take a couple of steps back. So I know that this kind of distinction between what we think of, blue collar and white collar. I mean, we're on the radio. I actually am wearing a blue collar because it's a blue scarf and I'm wearing a white blouse. So I've kind of got both going on here. And I'm going to link back to, COVID. And in that, I think there was so much discussion about remote work going on. Yet, according to the Society for Human Resource Management, 55% of the working population never had a choice to go remote. It was in person. It's always going to be in person. So there are kind of universal things. Is one, you may have to have conflict resolution skill competency done through video. I think most people would say, I'd prefer to do it in person. Well, most people would prefer to, I think most people would prefer not to do it at all. And hopefully that it just goes away or it lessens. However, if people feel as though their expectations are not being met by the boss, by the coworker, by the customer, by the owner, that's kind of universal. So rather than trying to jump in and fix a problem at first, as an HR or as a business owner or as a manager, like, well, what's the problem I need to fix? Let's try to figure out how each person is defining the problem. So I go back, and it's kind of, I think, of a universal thing of that in every piece of tension or conflict or disappointment or frustration, we had an expectation and that expectation wasn't met. So if your listeners want to go back to, like, what was the consumer experience you had? that wasn't great. So what expectation did you have about a boss or a coworker? What expectation that you did you have? You know, with an employer, what expectation did you have? If you're an owner, what expectations do you have from other people? And if we can figure out what our unmet expectation is and figure out why is this causing me so much irritation, frustration versus a, whatever. I think that kind of gives us, you know, an entryway to start a conversation about it, to find out what's going on with other people. I had mentioned like what I kind of liked about being a mediator and a trainer. And what I liked best about being a lawyer was when people would come, you know, when we'd make an appointment and the day that people would come into our offices and we'd sit down and I'd say, what's going on? What are you looking for help with? And I started with a question, and it was very much not to find the truth of the truth, capital T, that was going on, or their truth, the little t that was going on. But it was just really trying to find out from their story what was important to them and what they wanted rectified because something important was felt was feeling threatened. That's kind of the huge piece. And I also think a kind of a universal theme is if you think your title has a job description of fixer, you're going to jump in and start fixing stuff, but you're going to fix stuff based on your life experience and your title and what authority you think you have. And so sometimes they may not be wanting you to fix it in that particular way. And I see that escalating conflict of people playing fixer or also, as I said before, if people feel as though if bosses, managers, coworkers feel, oh, it's just going to get resolved. Don't worry about it. It'll blow over. It may de-escalate, but like a volcano, it's still boiling under the surface. And it doesn't necessarily go away. And people judge HR professionals and judge owners and managers of like, one of the worst things, aside from being labeled passive aggressive, is being labeled conflict avoidant, which is a way of saying you're not doing what I think is universally accepted as part of your job. And you're letting me down because you're not doing that part of your job.
I think that that kind of foundational expectation standard is just so very important. We are at that time where we just need to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Being a father is an honor, a challenge, a duty, a celebration, and a testimony. I want to be legendary for you because I found everything to live for.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and our guest today is Carol Bowser, attorney and founder of Conflict Management Strategies. And today we're discussing conflict management at work. Prior to the break, we were having a great discussion about kind of some of the foundational elements that go into where conflict is developed from. You know, Carol, I would love to turn to one of these great questions that you've indicated that you often ask clients and the importance of it. With that question being specifically, how was conflict handled in your home growing up? Why do you find that this question is so important when you are training and discussing conflict resolution strategies?
For a couple of different reasons, we kind of get imprinted of what the role models were at home or the lack of role models at home. Well, for some people, abuse happens. If you look at the statistics, you know, a lot of kids grow up in either emotionally or physically abusive households. Then there's also addiction and alcoholism and those types of things. So that also makes for a bit of a unstable, unpredictable place. And so for some people, it could be that retreating and avoiding and leaving the room or disconnecting or placating the other people literally was a survival tool. And I think that we carry over what was role modeled for us. We don't take a moment to examine it. We're like, oh, well, this is just the way, this is just the way it is. It's completely fine. Or maybe it's not completely fine, but this is the way that my life experience has said that it's really important to do. So let's contrast that with a household that was really comfortable with like big emotion, not abusive, but really big emotion. And maybe they were really direct. It was like, okay, we have it, we have words, and then it's done and we move on. It's almost like what I refer to as kind of an emotional guillotine. It's done, it's dead, we move on. It's as though it's never existed. And then for those people, they get really confused as to why people get upset with them. It's like, oh, you know, it's done, it's over with. But for other people, that same instance is likely part of a narrative of, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. So for our HR pros and, you know, the business owners out there, and Tani, you'll remember this, when people bring allegations of harassment, discrimination, and retaliation, the legal standard is the totality of the circumstances, and a whole bunch of what seemingly are small incidental, or one thing happened 6 months ago, one thing happened 9 months ago, one thing happened 18 months ago, 2 years ago. Well, the lawyer in me goes, statute of limitations, you know, for some of these, depending on the state or thing, it can go back 3 years. So people can go back and do a narrative 3 years ago and still bring a claim. You know, if they want to bring a federal claim, it's a shorter time period. But say you're not worried about harassment or retaliation. Say you've got long-term employees. They'll say, hey, I remember that when we had something similar to this 6 years ago, you lost your mind over this. Or, you know, if you've got, I often work with public entities and quasi-public entities and organizations that have collective bargaining units. A little asterisk here, it's because if there is conflict in the workplace that the collective bargaining agreement does not touch on, it's not an arbitrable thing. So oftentimes they'll bring me and say, hey, Carol, we've got these two union members that are clashing, or we have management that's clashing, or we've got like a work group that it's not a collectively bargained thing, but there's bad juju going on. So going back to the main point, if you have longstanding employees, they remember how stuff was handled. And also, again, for the managers and leaders and supervisors, longstanding employees know that they're there for the long term, that they have 10 years of 30, 20, 10 years. And generally, managers, you guys cycle every 2 to 5 years. So when I have managers say, like, they're not willing to do anything, you know, they're not willing to change, they're just kind of waiting me out. And I'm like, well, yeah, of course they are, because history has said you cycle out. So when you're trying to make massive substantive cultural change, they're like, you're going to be leaving, you know? So then the conflict is something different. It's not conflict blowing up. It's this underlying tension of how do we move forward as a group when there are maybe internal or external factors that need the culture or the way of adapting things to change.
No, and it is interesting because I find so often when you're talking to employees or we are managing a conflict, they will bring up something that happened 7, 9, 12 years ago with different managers, different leadership, all that kind of stuff, but that's still important to them. And you know, as you're trying to move forward, sometimes it's difficult to balance their perception of this is important. We're not trying to minimize it, but how do we look to the future? And I mean, that kind of leads me to my next question, which is, you know, if you were to identify two conflict resolution skills that maybe we're not taught, I mean, in lots of ways, we're taught certain conflict resolution skills when we're children, and then I think we stop focusing in on it a lot, you know, as we grow and become adults and enter the workforce. But what do you believe are maybe two that aren't taught, but that are important skills that we should have in this arena?
This is going to sound very familiar to people, but I will say active listening. And I know some of your listeners might be going, oh, that's a groaner, Carol, know that. Okay, so let me ask you what I think is my go-to question. What are you actively listening for? So active listening, it isn't, you know, nodding your head and little verbalizations. You can be actively listening for, you know, what's the emotion that's underlying that? How intense is the emotion? And I think that we do ourselves a disservice when we think all intense emotion is yelling, screaming, hanging up, confrontational, aggressive, because it could just be people are just bottomed out. And so this goes to, you know, what are you listening for? I talked again about expectations. You know, I think start listening for people giving clues about what their expectations are of others, what their expectations are of the employer. And, you know, they may be right, and they may be wanting something that's legitimate. However, then the quantity or quality that they may be wanting may not align with organizational goals or organizational resources. So listen for what their unmet expectations are. And then the other thing is, I tell this to my son, you know, eyes up, ears up, head on a swivel when we're going out, you know, hiking or going out through a parking lot. And let's translate that to the workplace. Eyes up, ears up, head on a swivel. I don't think people are really told you need to be on the lookout for what the emotional climate is. Have people laughed? Are people stressed? Are people stressed to an undue degree? Has been low-level stress for a continuous amount of time? Because even that low-level stress, it's like a little pinprick in a tire or a balloon. It deflates over time. And the other thing, if it's a lot of different things, if it's economic uncertainty, I'm here in the Pacific Northwest, and though I travel a lot of different places, right now as we're speaking in the Pacific Northwest and throughout the tech industry, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of layoffs, and people are freaked out about that. And I have been working for years now with higher education. And higher education, whether it's public or private, they are freaked out about the economic realities that there aren't as many people going to college and they have to make economic cuts. So a lot of people who thought that they had kind of forever jobs at a forever employer are now freaked out. So being able to recognize the freak out and not placate people, but let's not just pretend that it doesn't exist and put your head down and start talking about, you know, how might the stress be impacting? We can't control the world, but are there things that we can do to help support one another? Because I'm seeing more things pop up because of life stresses and economic stresses that are translating out to blow-ups or confrontations or conflicts in the workplace. Because if people can't control the world, they're going to try to micro control the things they do have control over with. And then that causes more difficulty.
No, absolutely. And kind of going back to that whole person and kind of expectations, I think it is so important to recognize that. I mean, when we're talking about active listening, we're really focusing in on how we communicate with others. And you know, I highly recommend, and it'll be in the link for this show, but that people check out your website. But you have a great blog post that I really enjoyed about stonewalling from a communication strategy energy standpoint, when you experience stonewalling, for our listeners who maybe aren't aware as to what that term means in a work environment, can you provide a brief explanation and then maybe some ways that employees can respond if they find themselves experiencing this while at work?
Stonewalling, as we're using it there, it means like people who fail to engage. And I will tell you, I'm a talker. You know, once I kind of get over the emotional, we're like, oh my God, what's going on here? And even I do that because I've got skin in the game. I've got a reputation that I want to protect. And some things take me off my game and make me nervous. But the thing that infuriates me and infuriates others is when somebody fails to engage. And that could mean like your emails aren't getting returned, phone calls aren't getting returned, Slack messages, anything like that, that people that you're trying to do it and they are just avoiding you and not engaging at all. And it can be in a variety of ways. My friend from the Midwest, and when I've worked with clients in the Midwest, they call it, well, it's the Midwest nice, which means that we're going to kind of kill you with politeness, but we're not going to talk about things that are important, which is a way of stonewalling, saying I'm not going to engage. And so for the listeners out there, then you are compelling someone to live in their points of pain independently. And also they believe that you have the power and the ability to influence or to make some type of change. So, you know, if they're coming to you with request or they feel as though it's part of their expectation of you that you can and should be doing something, I mean, it's kind of a compliment. It might be an uncomfortable conversation with you, but that's the, so I've heard it in the Midwest nice. I've heard it in the South where it's, well, bless your heart. Or someone told me most recently, like, because I was just in Louisville, Kentucky, presenting at a national conference. And they said, well, when you go to Louisville, do not say, bless your pea picking heart, because that's like, oh, no, you didn't just say that. Or, you know, maybe up in New York where it's a stonewalling where they're trying to build a wall to push you back so much and overwhelm you. That is amazingly frustrating. So sometimes it will need to be a direct conversation of, look, I am coming to you because this is an area of concern and frustration for me. And I believe that you are part of helping to address this or part of the solution. So that's really hard. It's almost like you're having to woo them into the conversation. And if they are reluctant to have the conversation, then being able to say, I want to have a conversation about this. I want to hear what you have to say. And I want to think about it a little bit. So you're kind of pulling them in first before overwhelming them.
That's, I think, so super helpful. And especially specifically as it relates to different locations and having different forms of stonewalling, something that I never would have kind of considered the geographic nature of it.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit of a cultural thing too. And I would just say is like, I think stonewalling is a way of avoiding. And I always like to think of like two different sides of the coin. But, you know, for those who feel as though they're not being heard, I mean, have you overwhelmed them? Have you made the same request over and over and over and over again? And have you actually been given an answer, but you're trying to persuade them to change their mind, or you're trying to go back and undo a decision that the organization made? So that's like, you know, are you training someone not to listen to you? And that's why when I do my coaching work and my group work, I say, well, let's talk about ways in which you can reformat how you're saying it. So that way you are more likely to be heard. Because when in conflict, there's generally a lot of conversation, but it may not be productive conversation.
That's a really good point. Conversation for conversation's sake, it is very rarely, I'm guessing, helpful. With that, we are at a time where we need to take another break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Educational HR Radio is critical to your organization's success, and our sponsors understand the value this program brings to owners, C-suite professionals, and the HR community. We are honored to thank our sponsors for their support and contributions to this program. We thank the law firms of Verrill, Jackson Lewis, and Sheehan Finney, along with our partners, the Healthcare Purchase Alliance, Paper Trails, and Strategic HR. Want to be the next sponsor of the HR Power Hour? Text 603-303-6124 and say HR Power Hour sponsor.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and our guest today is Carol Bowser, attorney and founder of Conflict Management Strategies. And today we're discussing conflict management at work. You know, prior to the break, Carol, we were talking a lot about different forms of communication, the way that they can lead to additional conflict, how we can use communication skills, you know, in part to resolve conflict. In the past, you and I have had discussions about empowering employees and how people can use conflict resolution skills. But what are some ways or things that you can think of that could help managers to empower employees as it relates to taking control of their own conflict resolution?
So there are a couple of things. One, I just want to acknowledge that I have had several clients when I talk about empowering, because my tagline is managing conflict, empowering people. And I've had more than one employer say, Carol, I do not want these people more empowered. Meaning like, I've got enough. Enough empowerment, which I think means that that somehow that the communication has gotten stymied, that they that the employees and the different groups are very vocal about what they want and very vocal about their displeasure, yet it has gotten stuck. Or as we were talking before the break, it's gotten where people just don't want to hear it anymore because they feel like, again, going back to like that guillotine, hey, we had that discussion, we had that problem, it's done, we're moving on. However, I do think that every single employer, oh, good Lord, please let it be every single employer, have a handbook. And if you don't, you need to call your employment law counsel right away.
See, Carol saying it. It's not even Tawny saying it. This is
to
Carol
be able to
it.
Do it. Because, yeah, okay. That's a different topic. Even in the employee book or the guidelines that people have, it always says, if you have a challenge, go and talk to that person directly, which means, which is kind of employer speak for like, please don't get us involved in all of the crapola petty conversations at all. Try to resolve it on your own. And then if you don't, then you can go to your manager. If you've got a problem with your manager, then go to HR and keep going up the chain. So everyone has that. I think that is good. Yet it doesn't acknowledge that people for 99.9% of the time, they don't want to have the conversation because they're really concerned, one, that it's not going to do any good, two, that the person who they want to have the conversation with is going to lose their mind, and or that the person they're having the conversation with is somehow going to retaliate against them. So if you can imagine the fear of retaliation, fear of what the other person is going to do, and a reluctance to have the conversation, because maybe in past employment conversations, it didn't go well. Maybe there is an existential fear of being retaliated against because you don't want to be that guy or that girl or the person who or them that is viewed as annoying or a whiner. And then therefore that's going to undermine your professional reputation, which is then going to undermine career opportunities for you. So, I mean, there's a whole lot of reason not to have the conversation. So if you can train people to say, okay, it's beyond giving and receiving feedback. It's more about putting on a curiosity cap and being able to say and articulate, what are my expectations of people? And being kind of clear on that. And for HR in specific, in as much as the culture responsibility and the climate responsibility is kind of, I think, usually dumped in HR's lap. I think HR can be a really good navigator for that, but people confuse navigator with captain and ultimately responsible. It's how are we teaching and training our managers to encourage people to come to us beyond, hey, I've got an open door policy or give me a call. But being able to say, like, how are you demonstrating listening so that way you are the eyes and the ears of the organization to be able to translate what people's expectations are, if they're meeting the expectations, and then also training employees how they can make requests of each other. Because if we can make requests that are well received and we understand the power structures of how much autonomy we're giving the employees to make changes versus structure that managers, supervisors, and leaders are retaining decision-making control, I think that's huge. So let me take that down to bullet points. If you can be clear on what levels of authority, including levels of freedom people have, and train them on asking questions about, how can we do this? You know, help me understand why we're doing this. What's my role in this? I think going back to what I said before, let's take several steps back. So if we're kind of clearer on what our expectations are of each other as human beings and coworkers and what's appropriate versus inappropriate at this workplace, or just saying, hey, that just kind of hit me the wrong way versus saying you're discriminating against me. Or that just felt really weird. What's going on with this? What's happening? I'm not understanding why we're getting this reaction, or I'm confused as to why it feels like we're having the same conversation over and over again. So those are like, you notice that those are a whole bunch of questions, which means like I need to figure out from my point of view what the concern is beyond the this person is pissing me off and they're irritated and I'm feeling as though they're an impediment to my life and my work, to being able to frame questions in a way and then keep framing the questions. I want to give a little warning. A lot of this stuff isn't a one and done conversation. It's kind of a continuing conversation because it's a continuing relationship. And a lot of people are going to go back default to what they've done before simply because that's where our brains work. It's easier that way. We don't have to do less work. We don't have to remember that we had to do something different, then remember the framework, then remember the tool for the framework. But I mean, just think about it. How many times have each one of us tried to do something new and after a couple of weeks abandoned it because it became too emotionally or mentally stressful, or quite frankly, we just forgot.
No, I think that's so important. And I mean, I think for me, one of the takeaways here is that idea or concept that like the communication has to be well received. If it's not well received, then it's likely not going to be heard. And, you know, you've talked in the past about how we can assist in helping that communication being more well received. And one of the things you've talked about is telling someone to calm down isn't helpful. Can you explain a little bit more about why you say that or why you believe that, have found that to be true?
Absolutely. So if you can imagine something that is important enough for you to think about it, maybe ruminate on it, to be able to pick up a phone, type an email, set up a Slack team message, walk down the hall and talk to somebody about it. It's like if it wasn't important in some way, shape or form to them, it wouldn't be an issue. It'd be a, whatever, you know, it's not even on my radar screen. And so oftentimes when people are feeling frustrated that they're not feeling successful at work, and let's just pause there. Work is how we feed our families. Work is how we make a mortgage. Work is, for the vast majority of Americans, how we get access, if we get access, to healthcare. And if people aren't feeling successful, if they are feeling threatened, if they are feeling impeded in that work, then it's a big deal. And it might not be that little thing. I remember early on when I first moved up to Washington, I worked at a hotel front desk and they had a little notebook. My understanding, listen to that. My understanding was that it was like to be able to pass from one shift to the other about kind of important things because, you know, hotels work 24 hours. So I went at the beginning of my shift to go look at it. And then someone else was writing down, well, Carol was 10 minutes late. And I think, dude, I was on property. I'm working with the banker yes. and, you know, I'm doing this. And I thought that is not the purpose of this. And I took umbrage to it because one, it's like, that's not what I understood to be the intention, that if people did have concerns about showing up on time or leaving early and they noticed, that's something they take up with a manager or a supervisor. And it seemed to me, and I'm getting umbrage just thinking about it, it happened like 25 years ago. That seemed to me like what we would call passive aggressive of like, you don't want to talk to me. However, looking back, it's like, I don't know, maybe she wasn't comfortable talking to me. Maybe she thought that was the purpose of it. Maybe she thought that the manager or supervisor would take a look at it and then talk to me. Maybe she didn't think it was her place to tell the manager or supervisor. Maybe she thought it was the manager's and supervisor's responsibility to notice. So all of these things get us to have to take a look, to ask us pause, invoke the power of the pause and say, what is it about what seems to be seemingly insignificant is actually, and people can steal this, symbolically significant, that they are giving it as an illustration of a larger problem or of an ongoing problem that they believe from their point of view is resolvable and that somebody isn't doing their job. So that's kind of what I go through. Like, what is it that's symbolically significant of, you know, if we do it, it's not a big deal. I mean, you look at it from if you have kids or you see kids, like they can have freaking meltdowns about, depending on the age, about anything. And as adults or grownups or people who have to act as adults or grownups, it's like I'm not understanding in the wide scheme of everything in the world of why they're upset. And it's like, well, maybe because you have more emotional stamina, you have gone through more things and you have developed strength in that muscle or have a different perspective. Let's get down to what their perspective is. Like, help me understand why this is important. And I'm also going to give a little caveat here. Most people, managers, supervisors, owners, will not start with the big thing. They're going to start with a little thing to test the waters to see how you are going to respond. If you are going to stonewall, if you are going to dismiss, if you're going to lose your ever-loving mind on them, because how you handle the little things, and if you are showing impatience or reluctance or avoidance, they are saying they're not going to do the big things. Think about it when you go to the doctor. You talk about little things, and doctors talk about the hand on the doorknob conversation of like, you think you're done. The doctor has his or her hand on the doorknob and just about open it. And then the patient says, well, you know, there's this other thing. And then all of a sudden the other thing is the big thing, but the doctors were going through their own protocol of this. And maybe that thing wasn't within the protocol and they were just kind of testing. Well, there's this kind of, let me just kind of ask you about the other thing. It's similar.
So many important concepts there. We're at that time again. We need to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
As the list of compliance challenges for businesses continues to grow, it's time to think about your payroll vendor as someone that can do more than just pay your employees. I'm Chris Clef, president of Paper Trails. We're a team of fun and local experts purveying convenient, high-tech payroll and compliance services across New England. Whether your business is struggling to stay compliant with an earned paid leave law, you're worrying about retirement savings programs, or you have questions about your state's paid family medical leave, Paper Trails has the team and tools necessary to allow you to handle the work while we handle the paperwork. To learn more about Paper Trails and how we can help your business, visit papertrails.com/HR Power.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and our guest today is Carol Bowser, attorney and founder of Conflict Management Strategies. And today we're discussing conflict management at work. Carol, you know, I have so very much enjoyed our conversation today. I've certainly learned a lot about conflict management and kind of understanding people as they come into the process. You have a lot of experience working with people. And if you were to kind of identify one of the most difficult things that leaders in organizations currently are faced with, what would that be?
I think just kind of mental and emotional exhaustion. The last several years have really catalyzed a lot of change. And then the current economic situations with inflation and wanting to be able to recruit and retain employees and also keep employees engaged. It's a lot of work. And I just want to acknowledge that for leaders, you know, owners, HR folks, there is this part of your job description is you need to be looking out for your people. And that's a lot of responsibility given all of that. And very few times are you ever going to get 100% emotional backing of, you know, all the different stuff or acknowledgement. So I just want to acknowledge for you all, it's tough. And I get it. Thinking back to a book that I read that was a resource for families who had someone with Alzheimer's and dementia, the thing that I took away from that book that I put into my own practice is, like, you know, it may not be a big thing. It could just be a series of small things. But if it's small things every single day and it is unrelenting, and owning a business or being a man, it is unrelenting. There is no kind of endpoint unless you die or you leave. And then it's just recognizing that you can't be at your best when there is constant emotional and mental taxing. And when you're not at your best, your staff knows it. And they will either try to safeguard you or avoid or minimize things. And that means you may not be getting information. So, you know, in as much if you need to lay on the floor and take a couple of deep breaths or whatever it is, I just want to acknowledge it is really hard work, and also how you respond and how you are demonstrating clearly, tenaciously, conflict resolution skills and listening, and very considerate that you're taking other people's voices into your decision-making process, even if you don't agree, that you saw them, you saw what was important to them, and you considered it and had to go a different direction for other reasons, which may not be open for public consumption. So I don't want you in the short term to create more problems. It's going to be more emotionally and psychologically tolling for you. And then that's going to roll down to the business or the organization, because you can't be at your best when you're constantly being worn down without some recuperative time.
Carol, thank you so very much for your time today. I mean, it's been a great show. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. For our listeners who want to connect with you offline, how would be a good way for them to contact you?
So you can follow me on LinkedIn. I regularly post and curate articles and videos so people can influence our conflict resolution muscles. You can go to the website, managingconflict.com. Follow on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, and I hope that everybody has an opportunity to pick one tool or one insight to operationalize it, because no, as one client said, no one ain't doing, and all of this is great, and just pick something once and start implementing it and try to do it diligently and see how it makes a difference.
Thank you so much, Carol. You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.